Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/truetransparencypricing. Happy you'll be if the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
I'm about to accomplish something that no one thought could ever be accomplished. I'm going to unite Paul Kuharsky and Clay Travis over a common topic, an issue right now. Clay, you tweeted last night that you were loving watching your 8-year-old son watch the Atlanta Braves. Even though you're not a Braves fan, he has taken to that team. And you're seeing baseball now through his eyes again. What has that process been like for you?
It's not just baseball. It's all sports. I think the best thing about being a parent is, at least if you're a sports fan, is getting to go back in time and sort of nostalgically relive the way you felt as a sports fan when you were 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, before you became bitter, cynical, and jaded at the world. And like he's collecting baseball cards, for instance, right now. And it's fun to go through baseball cards and everything else. So I think he is, my middle son is at kind of a perfect age. And so we were watching the Braves game last night before bedtime. And when Acuna got the hit, I mean, he was just ecstatic. And like I tweeted, I said, you know, he doesn't know the tortured October history of the Atlanta Braves because it's totally foreign to him. And I'm uncertain whether I should just sort of let him know what he's likely in for, because 1995 to him might as well be 1945 in terms of, oh, well, they won a title in 1995. It's like, you know, when I was a kid, that's like hearing about something that happened in 1960.
What's more fun, watching, because I don't have kids yet of the age where they're really playing a lot of sports. What's more fun, watching your kid play or being present with your kid when you're watching something you're both interested in sports-wise?
Well, sometimes watching games can be stressful because you want to be a supportive parent, but you're also, I don't know, I'm competitive. So, I coach Little League, and I think one of the most challenging things about coaching Little League is sometimes, like, you know, when you're coaching Little League, you want some other little kid to strike out because it helps your team's chances to win. But you're also like, guys, kind of feel bad when kid's got two strikes on him, and you're like, if he hits it, he's probably going to get on the base. But if he strikes out, that's huge for us. So you know, you're sitting there rooting for a 6-, 7-, 8-year-old to strike out in Little League because it helps your team's chances to win. So I think just sitting and watching a game where you're both rooting for the same side is really pretty awesome. Whether it's college football, NFL, or certainly Major League Baseball or anything like that.
I like them both, but my kid's still very much a wanderer in terms of who he's rooting for. So watching him play, also because of the social element, I'm lucky enough that the teams that he's been on, especially baseball-wise, he's been with the same kids forever, and I'm very close with all of those parents and stuff. So it's a real community thing, and that's been a treat that I never really expected. When we had him.
Yeah, look, I think that's one of the, I've coached Little League basketball, not a head coach, just the assistant coach for Little League basketball and also for Little League baseball with one of my neighbors. And it's pretty awesome. I mean, I know you probably look back in time and enjoy it even more than you are while you're doing it, but it's a pretty fun experience, especially, man. Now, maybe 4- and 5-year-old is tough because it's like it's hard to get them to pay attention to anything, so that can sometimes be frustrating. But if they get to be like 8, 9, 10 years old, they get old enough to be able to follow instruction, and you can see them improving on a day-to-day basis. That's a pretty gratifying and fun experience.
Clay, you always stumble upon the best stories every time I join you on your show on Friday mornings. And this morning I was surprised to be talking about a French-Canadian composer being attacked by a grizzly bear in Northwest Canada. And you are so into this story that you're thinking about creating a podcast series with it. Tell us about the story first for those who haven't heard it and all the questions surrounding this grizzly attack.
Yeah, so we do a segment on my morning show called Animal Thunderdome, where we kind of follow animal and human interactions that often end poorly for humans. And so, and my, you know, the staff that I work with is constantly looking for them, and I will quiz for details as we unpack some of these stories. So this French-Canadian composer was camping, like you said, up in Northwest Canada, and he just gets killed by a grizzly bear. But the details don't really make sense when you look at all the different things. First of all, he's there with two different women. Each of them is in a different tent. And they said they didn't realize really what had happened until 7:45 the next morning. And none of this adds up to me because the sun comes up by 5:30 or 6 a.m. there this time of year. And you would think if a guy gets killed by a grizzly bear and dragged to his death in the middle of the night, that you would at least hear it, you know, and potentially, even if you're not willing to try to fight the grizzly bear off, at least be aware, hey, when the sun comes up, things are probably not going to be that good for our buddy here, the French-Canadian composer. And so I'm fascinated by this story in general, because sometimes, but we had a story a while back where a woman was like, hey, I think this was in India, a monkey came into my bedroom, took the baby, and threw it down the well. And I was like, well, that, first of all, is like the antichrist of monkeys, right? Like, of all the things that a monkey could do, like, I mean, I understand they're sometimes difficult to deal with, but you go into somebody's home, steal their baby, and you immediately take it outside and just throw it in the well, and I'm like, you know what, I'm not buying this story. I don't think the monkey would make that decision. I'm not saying a monkey might not harm a kid, but to pick this baby up, carry it all the way to the well, throw it in the well, I'm like, I think something else happened here. Mom ended up doing it, right? Mom is, has got postpartum or whatever it is, and so that's the story there, right? I don't know all the details, and we're going to try to unpack them, but I'm not buying that a grizzly bear can drag somebody off in the middle of the night. You don't hear it, and you don't notice it happened until 7:45 the next morning. Something is not adding up here, and I want to know what that something is.
Julien Gauthier is the name of the composer, and we discussed this, Clay, but think about sacrificing for your art. That as a music composer, you decide to be the one to go into the Northwest Territory to record animal sounds. And he didn't contract this out to someone else.
Yeah, he's trying to record nature sounds.
I mean,
dedicated to his craft.
Seems like a job for someone else and not the composer to go and do this.
Yeah, and also, I'm not an expert. I don't enjoy camping. So let's put that out there. I understand there are some people who are big campers. I think the reason why we built structures is to avoid having to sleep on the ground. And so I don't consider that to be a positive thing, to go back into ancient human history and be sleeping on the ground again. So I don't enjoy that. I don't enjoy putting up tents. I don't enjoy any of that process, the insects, the bugs, everything else. I'm not a camp guy, right? I'm fine walking in the wilderness, but I want to finish the day inside of a physical structure. So granted there. But I also noticed it seems strange to me that if you were camping in a grizzly bear-infested part of the wilderness, that you would have three different tents instead of just one large tent that everyone would sleep in. This seems like a strange decision to begin with. And then, that again, if you're sleeping next to somebody in a tent, when the few times that I have been camping, it's very loud, and you know, like you hear noise very much in the darkness when you are sleeping in a tent, and you are always like, "Oh my God, you know, was that a bear? Was that a deer? You know, like what's making that noise in the woods?" That someone would be capable of being dragged away by a grizzly bear and wouldn't be aware of it seems highly improbable to me.
Tom Brady has been denied a Tom Terrific trademark by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. I like to think that this bodes well for the case against Ohio State being able to trademark the, or as Kirby would say, the.
The.
what do you think their chances are, Clay, at getting the or the?
0%. I think they were just trying to get attention for the fact that they now have all these products marketing the Ohio State University. I think, you know, the general rule is that somebody else using it, I've got a few trademarks, right? Like, I have to trademark to OutKick. There's a difference between trademark and copyright. It's kind of a fascinating area of the law. But in general, you have to be the person who is basically making the phrase a useful one for purposes of commerce in some way, right? I'm just roughly approximating. So the Nike, which I think is the Greek god of victory, existed beforehand, right? It's not like Nike came up with that word, but they have the right to copyright it in the context of athletic shoes and athletic apparel. and Amazon. You know, the Amazon River existed forever, but Amazon has the right to a variety of copyrights that are associated with selling internet commerce, and you wouldn't be able to infringe on those trademarks associated with their logos and everything else. So I think Tom Terrific probably was not specific enough, or somebody else already had a claim to use that product, and something similar would have occurred as well with the which is just too common of usage. Like, I can't just trademark the word superb and be like, hey, you know, I've got use of the word superb exclusively. Now I could come up with a company called Superb or something like that, come up with a logo. But in terms of being able to restrict other people from using it, it would be difficult.
Clay, what'd you make of the Dolphins playing nothing but Jay-Z music to start a practice after Kenny Stills criticized Jay-Z and the partnership with the NFL?
Well, I thought that was really funny by Brian Flores. And I know he's maybe said some stuff since then as a, you know, like a response. I didn't hear all of his quotes since then. But we're in an upside-down universe when NFL players are criticizing Jay-Z for not being woke enough. I mean, I don't even know what the universe of absurdity we are in. But it's funny also when you're like, I don't know why Jay-Z is taking money from the NFL. Like, that's him being a sellout. You, as a player, are taking money from the NFL. Like, everybody who takes money from employers is selling out in some way. Selling your labor, defining selling your labor and your time as a sellout definition, is to be ridiculous. If you care so deeply about your political leanings that that you don't believe you should be able to take money from any capitalistic organization, then maybe you shouldn't be employed as a football player either. So I think it's really funny when you say somebody's selling out for doing the exact same thing that you're doing.
Clay, we've got college football this weekend, Florida and Miami. I think this is a great tool for teams to use for both these programs to get that early week jump and get the spotlight where everyone's going to be watching because we're all starved for football. What a great selling point for Florida and Miami to be on where everyone's going to be watching on Saturday.
Yeah, well, they're doing like this 150-year anniversary, I think, is the reason why they're kicking off on the 24th. And there's also the Hawaii-Arizona game, which is airing later in the evening. But yeah, look, I love it. I wish college football started sooner. I wish they would just put in a couple of extra bye weeks. I kind of feel the same thing about the NFL. I don't understand why we wouldn't want the NFL season to go all the way up to President's Day weekend. And I don't, college football is so short, right? I mean, of all of our sports, it is the shortest season by far. And we spend so much time talking about college football outside of the games. I love that we've got a big game tomorrow to watch. I'm excited to see what happens between Florida and Miami.
Clay, if you were running an NFL team right now, would you play your top players in the preseason at all?
No, I wouldn't put them on the field at all. I just think it's a good example is Florida and Miami are playing, right?
Yes.
And Auburn in a couple of weeks is going to be kicking off the season next week, I believe, against Oregon. Auburn is starting a true freshman quarterback in Bo Nix, who has never played a college football game before, and they are throwing him out there to perform in a massively important game against Oregon. If it's possible for 18-year-old kids to go from high school football to playing major college football games without anything other than practices that take place within the context of the practices themselves at the school, then how in the world can you argue that fully grown adults who are often multi-year veterans in the NFL need four games to get ready before they play week one? I don't buy it. And look, it doesn't mean that the games are going to be perfect. And in fact, in college football, early season games often feature errors and failures because the team just hasn't gotten well seasoned yet. And because there are a lot of 18 and 19 year old kids who haven't played in big games before and they panic a little bit on the big stage. But I think the NFL, as part of their new collective bargaining agreement, to do away completely with the idea of the NFL preseason. I think it's a waste. I think it's an insult to season ticket holders like myself and other people who are listening right now that we have to pay full price for two games that nobody cares about. And I think it's actually harmful for the team itself to risk the health of big-time bona fide stars by playing them in preseason games. So I would completely do away with the preseason. And if I coach the team, I would not allow my stars certainly to play in those games.
Clay, speaking of early season games, I think you could argue that Tennessee and BYU is going to be the most important game of the season for what's going to happen with Tennessee this year. I also think you can argue the most important game for Jeremy Pruitt and Tennessee is going to come in late November when they play Vandy, and the fact that they need to end that streak once and for all. We're going to build a topic on this, but I want to pose this question to you. On the Vandy side of things, is there anything possible that Derek Mason could not accomplish this year? Anything bad that could happen to Vandy football that would put him on the hot seat if he beat Tennessee in Knoxville this year and had four straight wins against the Vols?
I mean, I guess they could be 1-11, right? And the only win could come against Tennessee. And,
but would he even be on the hot seat next year if they were 1-11? And I'm being completely honest.
Yeah, I think he'd be on the hot seat if they went 1-11. Because, I mean, it's hard to be that bad. Now, I don't have their schedule in front of me right now. I know their first two games are Georgia and Purdue, if I'm not mistaken.
Georgia at Purdue and then LSU at home are their first three. Then they play Northern Illinois, who's not going to be an easy game.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think Vandy is not going to be very good this year. And I think they also have a really tough schedule. And so, but I think you're correct in that Vanderbilt has defined Derek Mason's success by him being able to beat an awful Tennessee team and an awful Tennessee era. And they are judging that based on Tennessee historically as opposed to Tennessee in the present day, when, frankly, beating Tennessee of late has been like Vanderbilt beating Kentucky. And so they're judging Tennessee by historic standards, not by present-day standards. And as a result, I think that has kept their expectations fairly low for Derek Mason, who, frankly, has been mediocre at best. But I think mediocre at best in beating Tennessee is a level of excitement that Vanderbilt fans are willing to embrace. And it's why I think Vanderbilt's a pretty good job. In a hyper-competitive universe of SEC football, I think the expectations and standards at Vanderbilt are still really low for football. And the other 13 schools would not accept the futility that Vanderbilt has produced in general under Derek Mason, but Vanderbilt will. And so that's a great job to get in the best city in the SEC, at the best school in the SEC. And I think Vanderbilt's perspective is we're happy with 5-7, 4-8, occasionally a 6-6. And we're not going to try to rock the boat. As long as he keeps delivering that, we'll roll with it.
Clay, to flip that and what Chad's saying, let's say Vanderbilt beats Tennessee. Is there anything Pruitt can do in year two if he loses to Vandy again? Let's assume like the top SEC schools are going to get their wins over Tennessee. But beyond that, you're big on you know what you have in a coach in year two of that yeah. job. What do you think for Pruitt? What's the bar for him?
Well, I think you look at Tennessee's schedule. They've got seven games that they'll be favored in at home. They have eight home games this year. They're not going to beat Georgia, probably. Georgia's going to be on a different caliber. I don't think they'll beat Florida, and I don't think they'll beat Alabama. So Mizzou, I think, is probably going to be better, and on the road it'll be tough. So I think Jeremy Pruitt, the ceiling to me for Tennessee this year, which would be an extraordinary accomplishment, would be if he could go 8-4. And Chad's right about how big the BYU game is as it pertains to being able to get to 8-4. I mean, Mississippi State, South Carolina, Kentucky on the road is a very winnable game. I think there's very reasonable expectations for Tennessee to be able to get to eight games if everything goes well. I think the floor should be 6, right? I think the floor should be qualifying for a bowl game. So while losing to Vanderbilt would be frustrating, I don't think if you lose to Vanderbilt and you go, let's say, 6-6 instead of 7-5, I don't know that it's a seismic difference. And I also, at that point in time, would wonder how competitive are they in the 6, right? Because Tennessee last year beat Auburn, top 25 team, beat Kentucky, top 25 team, and if they had correctly officiated the game against South Carolina and called that fumble on the goal line, you would have beaten South Carolina too. So I know there were some games where they were not very competitive, but overall I thought year one with Jeremy Pruitt was pretty solid. I think Jared Garantano is going to be solid this year at quarterback. I think Jim Chaney was a great hire and offensive coordinator, and that this is the year where we should start to see the impact of the Jeremy Pruitt coach defense. And so to me, yeah, the BYU game in week two is the one to circle as a big kind of jumping off point for what the Vols are going to be capable of this year.
Clay, appreciate it, man. Have a great weekend.
Hey, thank you all. Appreciate you having me.
Clay Travis, presented by thehomeloanexpert.com.